Our speaker this morning is Bob Bryant. He's on the GES board. He's a pastor of Cypress Valley Bible Church, and you are not going to find a clearer, more methodical, more biblically minded preacher than him. And I hope he remembers that I said that when they evaluate my salary this summer. But will you give him a round of applause as we invite Bob Bryant up here?
What an interesting introduction that was. Thank you, Sean. Let's pray. Father, I pray that you would grip our hearts in this hour and through the whole day on into tomorrow with the reality that Jesus is coming again, and for the happiness and the joy that brings as a result of an answer to our prayer, we'll give you thanks and praise. Amen. Okay, the title of my message or talk today is The People of the Apocalypse. The word apocalypse has come to refer to the horrible disasters at the end of the world. But actually, the English word apocalypse comes from the Greek word apokalypsis, apa, meaning away from, kalupto, meaning cover. So apokalypsis means take away the cover or unveil or reveal. It's the first word found in the book of Revelation. In fact, it is the word revelation. The word revelation is the word apocalypse, the apocalypse of Jesus Christ. And immediately, John, who's writing, gives us a promise about this book. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it. The word blessed can also be translated happy. I like that word better because I can relate to it better. I like to be happy, and I know that God wants us to be happy. The purpose of the book of Revelation is to make us happy. And if we take it to heart, we will be happy people. If we read the book of Revelation and aren't happy, we're misunderstanding what we're reading. If we take it to heart, we will be happy people. The book of Revelation was not written to scare us. It wasn't written to satisfy our curiosity. It was written to change our lives. And today, I hope that what we look at will be life-changing truth. Many of you have already familiar with what I'm going to share today, but just to look at it again should lift our hearts in a state of even greater happiness. That's my prayer as we focus on the people of the apocalypse. Now, the timeline that you see in front of you, the top of it, you're very familiar with: the rapture, tribulation, 2-3.5 year periods, completed by the return. We're going to look at the people during this time period, as revealed in the book of Revelation, chapter 6 through 19. Let me read from left to right who these people are, and I've listed them or put them on the timeline in order of when they appear on the scene. 10 kings, the rider on the white horse, the two witnesses, the 144,000, the beast, the dragon, the false prophet, the martyrs, and the rider. These are real people. Now, I've stretched it a little bit to say that the dragon is a people, as we'll see in a moment, but please bear with me on that. But all the rest are real human beings. They may be alive today, depending on how close we really are. They will all interact with each other during the tribulation period. Some of them are good guys, some of them are bad guys. They all have important information for us. There's something to learn from every one of them. I thought today it would be helpful to do a quick overview. We could spend, as I have done, a whole message on each one of them. So this is just the highlights, an overview that I think might be helpful for all of us here today. But we want to start with the 10 kings. We find the term 10 kings in Revelation 17:12. We see them in that one reference. This is not the first time that we discover the 10 kings in Scripture. We first find them in the book of Daniel. By the way, you should have a handout that has all these scriptures on them. There was one at every place, I believe. Daniel says in Daniel chapter 7 that there will be a fourth kingdom. 10 kings shall arise from this kingdom. Daniel is referring to a vision that God gave him that previewed four great kingdoms: Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. The fourth kingdom is Rome, represented by the iron legs in the statue, the vision that Daniel saw. These are the borders of the old Roman Empire with modern-day countries superimposed on those borders. As we take a close-up look at the fourth kingdom, Rome, we see that there are two legs that most likely represent the two divisions of the Roman Empire, east and west, and then the feet and the toes made of iron and clay, as Daniel is told. The iron and clay, the toes represent 10 kings, some of them iron, some of them clay, some of them weaker and some of them stronger than the others. So Daniel is being told that there is a coming a day where 10 kings will arise out of the fourth kingdom. That day is still yet future to us. Here is the map again with the divisions of east and west. So since 10 kings are coming from this kingdom, we should expect that there will be 10 world leaders or 10 leaders from 10 different countries within what was once the Roman Empire, 5 from the west, 5 from the east. I'm not predicting which ones these will be, but I'm only giving example. An example from the west, it could be the leaders of France, England, Germany, Spain, and Italy. From the east, it could be the leaders of Egypt, Jordan, Turkey, Romania, or Greece, again, as examples. Daniel is told about the 10 kings that will come out of the Roman Empire, what was once the Roman Empire. And then he tells us the most important thing about these kings in the famous Daniel 9:7-27. The translation is he. I've inserted the word they. I'll explain that in a moment. Here they shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, literally seven. But in the middle of the week, seven, he or they shall bring to an end sacrifice and offering. Most, if not all, English translations translate the word he, but as Zane Hodges alerted me, and to those of you that read Power to Make War, which was published in 1995, 22 years ago, Zane alerted us to the fact that this passage is much better translated, not he, but they. In fact, these are the words that Zane, just some highlights of what Zane put in his book, Power to Make War. We would have to translate with they. Only this translation harmonizes with the rest of the verse and the verse that comes before. So when we read Daniel 9:27, we should not think he, we should think they, particularly the 10 kings that come out of what was once the Roman Empire. What will they do? Daniel is told that they, the 10 kings, shall confirm a covenant with many, which is the many is Israel, for 1 week, or 1 7, which is a 7-year period. But in the middle of the seven years, they shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. Now the term sacrifice and offering tell us what this covenant is about. It's about a covenant to allow the Jews to rebuild a temple and where they can offer sacrifices and offerings. But in the middle of the 7 years, the 10 kings who made the covenant with Israel to build the temple, in the very midpoint of the tribulation, they will bring an end to that covenant and put an end to sacrifice and offerings. So they start off as good guys. They end up as bad guys. Because not only do they put an end to sacrifice and offering, but we're told in Revelation 17 that the 10 kings will give their power and authority to the beast, who we will learn more about in a moment. Now, as we consider the 10 kings, we should be happy people. I'll tell you why. Because we live in an age where we can see that God has set the stage for what we just read here this morning. You couldn't have a covenant with Israel if there was no Israel. You couldn't have a covenant with Israel to rebuild a temple unless Israel was in control of the old city of Jerusalem. You can't make a covenant with people that don't have anything to make a covenant, people not to make a covenant with or make a covenant about. But we are the most privileged generation to have lived in the 20th century. and seen the fulfillment of prophecy, God bringing the Jews back into the land, back into sovereign control of the old city of Jerusalem, we should be so happy as we read about this to realize that we are the privileged generation to live in an age where God, we have seen God set the stage for the fulfillment of the prophecies we've just read about the 10 kings. Second person of the apocalypse is the rider on the white horse. The rider on the white horse we read about in Revelation 6:2. Behold, a white horse. He who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him. And he went out conquering and to conquer. The rider on the white horse is identified without question in chapter 19 as Jesus himself. He comes on a white horse on the day of the rapture. He comes on a white horse at the day of his second coming. Chapter 6, which is the very beginning of the tribulation, he's coming to conquer. On the very first day of the tribulation, Jesus descends toward the earth on a white horse, conquering. What is he conquering at that time? He's conquering. He's bringing a victory for his bride, the church, as he takes us off of the earth to deliver us from the wrath that is to come, even beginning that day. And that refers to what it says there. He went out conquering, which is done on that day, and to conquer, because he's got conquering work to do during the 7 years culminating in his descent to the earth on the white horse at the culmination or the end of the tribulation. Happy? Are you kidding me? When we read this verse, we ought to be so happy to know that the rider on the white horse is coming to conquer on our behalf, to deliver us up off of the earth, to deliver us from the wrath to come. It's our blessed hope. And right here, even as the tribulation begins, we're given something as the church to be very happy about. The next people mentioned are the two witnesses. Notice they are placed at the same day as the rapture or the coming of the rider on the white horse, because we're told in Revelation 3 that God will give power. He says, I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days, which is exactly 3.5 years to the day, which means they have to begin their ministry on the day, the first day of the tribulation, which is also the day of the rapture. You can see here that there's a lot that happens on this day. The covenant goes into effect. It's made strong on that day because it's a 7-year covenant. The rapture occurs on that day because the rider on the white horse comes on that day. The tribulation begins on that day. The two witnesses begin their ministry on that day. Now, these two witnesses, as it says here in this verse, will prophesy. There's no doubt in my mind that part of their prophetic proclamation will be the saving message of Jesus that they want the whole world to listen to and hear and believe. And it says, as we go on in verse 6, that these have the power to strike the earth with all plagues as often as they desire. So when we read about the plagues in the first half of the tribulation, we need to realize that the two witnesses are the ones calling for these plagues. They are not popular people. The people of the earth hate the two witnesses, except for those that believe their message, obviously. And I left out the first part of the verse, but I thought last night I really should have included it, because part of the plagues that they call down is the lack of rain. It won't rain for the first 3.5 years of the tribulation. In fact, it says they shut up the heavens. Keep that word in mind, because that would refer not to the third heaven, but to the sky. They shut up the sky where it won't rain for 3.5 years. Their ministry lasts 1,260 days. What happens on day 1,261? We're told in verse 7. When they finish their testimony, the beast will make war. The beast will make war against them, overcome them, and kill them. This will be a very popular move on behalf of the people of the earth. They will celebrate, give gifts to one another in celebration of the death of the two witnesses. The world will rejoice and the beast will be a hero in the eyes of the world. Then we're told that after the 3.5 days, 3.5 days their bodies lay in the streets. After the 3.5 days that their bodies lay in the streets, the breath of life from God entered them. They stood on their feet and great fear fell on those who saw them. And they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, "Come up here." They ascended to heaven in a cloud and their enemies saw them. Now that voice from heaven, again, when you read the word heaven, you have to ask which heaven, first, second, or third. Is it the atmosphere, outer space, or the third heaven, the dwelling of God? I believe that this is the same heaven from which rain doesn't fall for 3.5 years. It's the atmosphere. It's the clouds. Wes Spradley talked about this yesterday. Jesus is in the clouds in what Zane Hodges calls a sky tent, where he is dwelling with believers and administrating what happens during the tribulation from his headquarters in the sky. The two witnesses will go up into the sky tent where Jesus is and where we will be. And it says here that their enemies saw them. Their enemies couldn't see them go all the way to the third heaven, but the people on earth could see them go up to the tent in the sky. Now, that book of Revelation was written to make us happy. When we read about the two witnesses, we just ought to be thrilled to read what God is going to do. He's going to raise up two witnesses, and it could be any day, who will proclaim the saving message of Jesus in a world that will hear it, and he will get the attention of the world through the plagues that the two witnesses call down upon the earth, because many times people don't listen apart from trial, trouble, and tribulation, especially the Jewish people, which we will talk about in a moment. We ought to be so happy to know that God is going to get the attention of the world through the ministry of the two witnesses. That leads us to the next people of the apocalypse, the 144,000. We're told who they are. They are 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel. And they were sealed, meaning set apart and protected. We're told in a verse that I don't have listed that these are the first fruits. These are the first fruits believers of the two witnesses. And they have a ministry in the world during the tribulation. That ministry is to the entire world, as we're told in a few verses later, where John says, "Behold, a great multitude, which no one could number, of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues." I'm going to tell you, this is one of my favorite verses in the whole Bible, Revelation 7:9. Not by itself, but because of what comes after it. When we read who these people are, now before I leave it, I want you to notice, a great multitude of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues. From every country, every tribe, every tongue in the world, there will be a great multitude of people from within each of these nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues. Who are they? These are the ones who come out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. One of my favorite passages in the whole Bible, Revelation 7. Because to be honest with you, I'm so discouraged about what's happening in our world today. The world population is exploding beyond what we can even grasp. And the spread of this true saving message of Jesus is not keeping up even close with the rapid expansion of the population of our world. I get excited. I get happy to read, God's going to do something about this. God loves the world too much to let this continue much longer, in my opinion. And Jesus said that the gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world. Again, one of my favorite passages in the whole Bible. That day is coming when everyone in the world will hear the true saving message of Jesus as we hear it here at GES. They're going to hear this message. Not a different message, but the true saving message of Jesus will be proclaimed. And we know from Revelation 7 how this verse in Matthew 24 will be fulfilled. It'll be fulfilled through and by the 144,000 Jewish evangelists. And if that doesn't make you happy, I don't know what will. So let's move on. let's get some bad news. I mean, it's all good news right now. Let's get some bad news because we know there's something bad going on in the tribulation, right? Okay, introduce you to the beast. That's the name most often used of him. It's found in many places, but Revelation 11:7 is one reference. The beast refers to his character. God says, he's a beast. He has other names. 2 Thessalonians 2:3 is the man of sin. Again, referring to his character, the man of sin. What a title that God gives to him. Daniel refers to him as the king of the north. That's a reference to the location from which he rises. Micah 5:6 refers to him as the Assyrian, which is a reference not only to the location from which he comes, but his race. He will be an Assyrian by race. Now, these maps help us to understand what we just read from Daniel and Micah. When Daniel referred to the king of the north, the northern kingdom in relation to Daniel was the Seleucid kingdom, which you see outlined in red on the map. So this future ruler will come from the region of the north, the Seleucid kingdom, as outlined by those borders. But he also tells us that he's an Assyrian, and there's an outline of the Assyrian empire from which we know this man must arise, since he's the Assyrian. When we combine those two areas, we come up with this designation. Based on the prophecies of Daniel and Micah, the beast will come out of this region. And since he is an Assyrian, not only by location, but by race, we need to think, are there Assyrians, a race of Assyrians in the world today? And yes, there are. And that little dot at the top of Iraq there is the modern-day country of Mosul. We hear it a lot. A lot of fighting goes on in Mosul. But Mosul is the old capital of Nineveh, where Jonah went. And Mosul, this area, is the central area of a very pretty large group of Assyrians. There are 2 million Assyrians in the world today. Most of them are located in northern Iraq in that particular area. So it shouldn't surprise us if he actually arises from that particular area. It's going to be somewhere in what's outlined that you see on the screen, but the Assyrians are in primarily northern Iraq, so we should expect that he would arise from there. When he arrived, we've talked about just the highlights of his race, his location. How long or when will he come on the scene? Daniel 8, 13, and 14 tells us this. The transgression of desolation, 2,300 days. What he's telling us there is that this transgressor of desolation, this man that we've been introduced to, will be on the scene for 2,300 days. All right, here's a little math to kind of bore you here. The entire tribulation will be 2,520 days. 2,520 days. He will be on the scene 2,300 days. That tells us that for the first 220 days of the tribulation, he will not be on the scene. He rises to power 220 days into the tribulation, which is why he's placed on the timeline where he was placed. Now, right before the midpoint, somewhere closely before the midpoint of the tribulation, we're told this in Revelation 13. I saw him as if mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. So he will be mortally wounded. People will think that he's dead. Maybe he will be dead for a moment, but not long, because his deadly wound was healed. The world marveled and followed the beast, partly because of what they see in this miraculous recovery of this man that they thought had died or would die. And shortly after this, the man of sin sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God, and it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. This all happens on the day that he kills the two witnesses. He kills the two witnesses, he goes into the temple, says I'm God, proclaims that he's to be worshipped as God, and he makes war with the saints. He sets his mission to persecute believers all over the world. His war is particularly waged, wanting to wipe out or take out the 144,000 witnesses. Much more could be said about him, but remember, these are just highlights today. Now, what in the world is there in here to make us happy? Wow, there's a lot to make us happy. Because no matter how bad things get in the tribulation, God's in control. I mean, we're just reading here. This guy thinks that he's in control, and God says, I wrote this 2,000 years ago. I knew what you were going to do, and I got it all covered here. You're just accomplishing my purpose and my plan. And so when we see the sovereignty of God fulfilled as we read about it in Revelation, it should make us so happy to know that God's got every detail covered. Not just what seems to be good, but what seems to be bad. He's working every detail to accomplish his purposes, leading to the return of Christ to this earth to reign as king. The next character is the dragon. Now, this title of the message is The People of the Apocalypse. That's a reach a little bit, because I'm not sure I could call the dragon a people, but he is a character. He's a real being. His identity is found in Revelation 12, 7 through 9. War broke out in heaven, so the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan. Not much doubt as to who the dragon is, very clearly identified. Then we read that after he is cast out of heaven, the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Now, the woman is Israel. I don't have time to get into explaining all the imagery or the symbolism, but it's very clear when you read Revelation 12 that the woman is Israel. After the beast, at the midpoint of the tribulation, says, sits in the temple of God saying, I am God. On that very day, the midpoint of the tribulation, Satan is cast out of heaven. Satan, as you know from the book of Job, has access to God. He comes to heaven and visits, accuses the brethren. But on this day, he and his other angels are cast out of heaven, down to the earth. The dragon is enraged, and his mission as he is cast down to the earth is to make war with the Jews, in particular those who have the commandments and the testimony of Jesus, which would be the 144,000. What's his deal? Why is he so enraged with the Jews? Why is Satan's, down through history, but especially as we read in the tribulation, why is he so intent on destroying the Jews? It's because in his twisted way of thinking, he still thinks he can frustrate the plan of God. If he can destroy the Jews, there will be no second coming, because Jesus comes to rescue the Jews. He comes in response to the salvation and the call of the Jews. If there are no Jews, then Satan can frustrate the plan of God. Jesus can't return according to the way he thinks, and he can continue on as ruler of this world. What in the world is there to make us happy? Well, we can be happy to know that God, as has always been, has used Satan in spite of his attempts to overthrow the rule of God over him and over the world, that God is still totally in control. He's going to use Satan to accomplish his purpose and his plan. His influence is limited only as far as God allows him to operate. Shortly thereafter, we see the rise of the false prophet. False prophet is a term or a title that's given to him or referred to him in Revelation 19:20. Revelation 13:11, he's called another beast. In 1 John 4:3, he's referred to as the Antichrist. It's interesting that the term Antichrist is not found in the book of Revelation, which some find as a surprise. It's only found in 1 and 2 John. And when you read the references to the Antichrist in 1 and 2 John, it's clear that he's talking about false prophets. So the Antichrist is not a term synonymous with the beast. Never is the beast referred to as the Antichrist, but the false prophet is, in the writings of John. And he is called the Antichrist as a false prophet against the Christ. And here's what he does. Revelation 13:12. He causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast. He causes all to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast, or the number of his name, 666. So, the false prophet carries out this plan of the beast to control the world, literally to control the world. So that if people don't take the mark of the beast, they can't buy or sell. It's a very serious issue, obviously, because you can't buy food, you'll starve, and your family will starve. And it's an attempt to literally control the world, to bring the world's allegiance to the beast. What in the world can make us happy as we read about the false prophet? Well, first, I think when we relate the false prophet to what John is saying in 1 John, we should first be thankful that we've been saved from the message of the Antichrist, which is very much alive today. John tells us that the message, the work, the spirit of the Antichrist is among us today in the false prophets of our day. And I know that all of us have a testimony here in this room of how we thank God for being saved from the false teachings that we once were under, most of us. Many of us were once under false teaching. And how God has saved us from the spirit of the Antichrist already when he opened our eyes to see our need of Jesus for everlasting life. And so right there we have an application for today as we look ahead to the Antichrist, to be happy that we've been saved from the spirit of the Antichrist, and happy that God is going to work during the tribulation for people to come to an account of, what am I going to do here? I can't pretend there's no God, because, by the way, there won't be any atheists during the tribulation. None, not one. Everybody's going to know that the God of the sky is alive. He's real. They're going to believe that Jesus is his son. And because they're blaming God for all these plagues that are coming down on the earth that the two witnesses say are coming from God. No atheists during the tribulation. They're either going to hate God, as many will, or they're going to turn to God in faith in his son, Jesus Christ, for everlasting life. And so I think we can be happy to know that the tribulation is going to be a time that God is going to use the beast, the dragon, the false prophet, to wake the world up to the reality that he exists and to the reality of what will you believe about what you're being told from the two witnesses and the 144,000. And the false prophet's message, in contrast to it, makes that message shine even more brightly. The next people of the apocalypse are the martyrs. Now, I put them on in the second half because that's where most of them will be martyred, is when after the beast proclaims that he is God, he makes war with the saints. So most of the martyrdom will occur during the second half. Now, the martyrs are a prominent theme in the book of Revelation. I traced it through. You can do that. Just trace through the martyrs in the book of Revelation. It's pretty amazing how often they're brought up. Now, here's just one passage, Revelation 20, verse 4. I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Apparently, beheading is the form of execution that the beast adopts for those that will not follow him. And notice that these martyrs refused to take the mark of the beast. They refused to give up their witness to Jesus, even in the face of death. And notice, they will reign with Christ for 1,000 years. They will be rewarded with the greater privilege of reigning with Christ and serving Christ in the future kingdom. Now, we should be very happy as we read about the martyrs, as sad as it is to think about their fate. We should be happy, first of all, to think that we live in a country where we know nothing of this. We live in a country where we don't fear being executed for our faith and our testimony for Jesus. We should never take that for granted. And thank God we don't have to face that. It should alert us to the fact that there are believers in our world today who are facing persecution. But I think that as we think about these martyrs of the tribulation, it should make us happy that they have given us such an amazing, awesome testimony to their faith and their courage, their perseverance, that we could say, I'm happy that God has given me the example of these people, because I don't know what suffering is, but for what little suffering I have, I want to be like them. And it makes me happy that God has given me such awesome examples in the testimony of these martyrs. The final person of the apocalypse is the rider on the white horse. Jesus, again, is seen on his white horse. He descended from heaven on a white horse. He's been in the clouds, and now at the end of the tribulation, on the final day, he descends back to the earth on his white horse. Now, as a prelude to this day, we're told in chapter 16, John says, I saw the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet, the kings of the whole world, gathered to the battle, gathered to the place called Armageddon. Now, you may be familiar, though, there's a valley in the north of Israel. It doesn't show. The Jezreel Valley, maybe you can make it out. The very top of the screen, there's a valley up there. That is the Valley of Jezreel, also called the Valley of Armageddon, a place called Armageddon. Here's a picture that perhaps you've seen where the armies of the earth will gather on this vast plain in this valley. Now, we just read that they gather for or to the battle, but there's no battle that takes place at Armageddon. This is just the gathering place where the armies gather. The battle takes place in Jerusalem. You know where Jerusalem is? It's down here, the city down here on the bottom, just to the west of the upper part of the Dead Sea. The armies are gathered in Armageddon, but they are in Megiddo, Valley of Jezreel. They're brought down. They're moved south for the battle that takes place in Jerusalem. And Zechariah, he describes or gives us a little bit of information about the battle. I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. Not each other. The battle, this so-called Battle of Armageddon, is not a battle of nations against each other. It's the gathering of the nations of the world against Jerusalem, and the Jews in particular in Jerusalem. But then we read that then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations, and in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. So the nations are gathered against the Jews. Again, why? I explained it earlier. It's Satan's last attempt to destroy the Jews, to frustrate the plan of God, because it's his last opportunity to destroy the Jews, to frustrate the plan of Jesus coming back to the earth. That doesn't frustrate Jesus. He comes down and fights against those nations to rescue the Jews, to deliver them from this onslaught of the nations of the world headed by the beast, the false prophet, and the dragon. He descends to the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives is on the east of Jerusalem. That's a picture looking west to east. The Mount of Olives is in the background to the east of the old city of Jerusalem. Here's an aerial view looking from the opposite direction, from east toward the west. The bottom of the screen is the Mount of Olives, that brown area. Then just above it is the old city. There's the Temple Mount in the old city. And beyond that is the is West Jerusalem. Now, that will be the viewpoint of you and me when we descend, because we're going to come back with Jesus. We're going to descend with Jesus back to the earth. And when you see that view, I want you to remember where you saw it first. Okay? That's the view right there. You're going to say, oh, I saw that. This looks familiar. It's going to be awesome. We read about this return of Jesus in Revelation 19. I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. And he who sat on him was called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and makes war. His eyes were like a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. The first time Jesus came into Jerusalem riding on a donkey to face pain and suffering, a crown of thorns is what he wore. This time he comes not to suffer and die, but to wage war. This time he doesn't wear a crown of thorns. He wears many crowns, designating him as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And I saw the beast, the kings of the earth and their armies, gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. Now, Zechariah told us that the armies of the earth gathered to make war against the Jews, against Jerusalem. That didn't work. Now Jesus himself is descending. Satan, the beast, and the armies of the earth moved to plan B, which is to wage war against Jesus himself. Plan A was to destroy the Jews to frustrate the plan of Christ's return. Now plan B is to wage war against Jesus himself. I think you know how that turns out. Revelation 19:20, the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet. These two were cast alive into the lake of fire. And Christ shall reign 1,000 years. There's nothing, nothing that could make us happier than that. People of the apocalypse, just to review, are the 10 kings, the rider on the white horse, the 2 witnesses, the 144,000, the beast, the dragon, the false prophet, the martyrs, and the rider. Happy is he who hears and who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and those things which are written in it. Okay. Did I leave time for questions? I should have followed John Clace's example and just kept talking, run out of time. That was a good plan.
First question, Bob, some think that the rider on the white horse who appeared after the Lamb opened the first seal is not Christ, but a false Christ. How would you defend your view?
I think it'd be very odd that you'd have the rider on the white horse clearly identified in 19 as Jesus and a different rider on a white horse in chapter 6. It just fits perfectly with what we know about the beginning, the rapture. Jesus comes to conquering and to conquer. Some have suggested that he wears a different type of crown, a Stephanos in chapter 6, a diadem chapter 19. Well, that makes sense because a Stephanos is a victor's crown. The diadem is a king's crown. In chapter 6, he comes with an arrow. Chapter 19, with a sword. Some have suggested that distinguishes those two, but that's totally unnecessary because during tribulation, he's fighting from heaven with an arrow. He's at a distance. But when he comes, he's coming with a sword, hand-to-hand combat. So there's no reason to distinguish the rider on the white horse as anybody but Jesus, in my strong opinion.
In 2 Thessalonians 2:3, the Thessalonians are to be encouraged because the day of the Lord has not come yet, which would be signaled by the appearing of the man of sin. If he does not show up for 100 days after the day of the Lord, Okay. The question is, then how is it that he appears 100 days after the day of the Lord begins?
I asked Zane Hodges that question. I was on the phone with him. I quoted to him, Zane, what about the day of the Lord, 2 Thessalonians 2? He said, Bob, I caught you red-handed.
That's a good
one. Reading from a critical text translation. Because the majority text does not say day of the Lord. It says day of Christ. So I've never forgotten that. That was a very humbling moment. The day of Christ is distinguished. The day of Christ is a technical term different than the day of the Lord. Day of the Lord is for the designates when the tribulation begins. But the day of Christ is the particular day referred to that has to do with the man of sin.
If the tribulation starts at Revelation 6:2, then what does Revelation 4 and 5, chapters 4 and 5, deal with?
Yeah, I'll let you answer that because you've just studied that at length.
I have?
Yes, you have. I know you have. It's the scene in heaven. It's a scene. Wait, the question is, the tribulation starts in 6. What's 4 and 5? It's a preliminary scene from heaven's perspective before the actual unfolding of the tribulation events.
Do you think there could be a period of time between the rapture and the beginning of the tribulation?
No.
All right. Are the martyrs that you mentioned, some of the 144,000, in other words, are some of them going to be martyred, or does that include believing Gentiles? I guess, or is it just believing Gentiles?
Yeah. I think that the 144,000 are sealed and protected. I think that's what we read in about them. But there will be many. The martyrs will be Jews and Gentile believers.
But not the 144,000.
I don't think the 144,000 because they're sealed, that they're for their ministry, protected.
Does the fact that the beast and the false prophet are thrown alive in the lake of fire suggest they are angels and not human? They do not appear at the great white throne? ?
Well, they're human for sure. The beast and the false prophet are human for sure. It's a good question that they apparently won't appear at the great white throne. But just because they wouldn't be at the great white throne doesn't prove that they're not human, in my opinion.
Where do the two witnesses come from? Are they unbelievers who believe on the first day of the tribulation? Believers who are not raptured? These are just options. Believers with God now who come back at the rapture.
Yeah. John Clay spoke to that yesterday. I don't know if it was here in his workshop. These are people like Paul who are Jews. Apparently they know a lot of Scripture. But on a given day they're born again, which is the day of the rapture. They're not believers before the rapture. They believe on the day of the rapture, but they apparently have a lot of training behind them before they believe.
Okay, last question. Other than the power to make war, what book would you recommend on the book of Revelation to understand the book of Revelation?
John Clase's book, The Impending Apocalypse. It's available at the 289 design booth.
Thank you very much.